Tax Relief. Testimonial from an actual client. Some restrictions apply. For complete details, please visit OptimaTaxRelief.com.
And now, Maine's best guest list, live from Bangor, this is Downtown with Rich Kimball.
And it's the second hour here on a Thursday afternoon. Rich Kimball with you. Carrie Haskell joining us live from New Orleans this afternoon. Downtown brought to you every day by Renewal by Anderson, your trusted window and door replacement expert of Greater Maine. Offering free in-home consultation, and they're rolling out here in the month of June their new Ensemble Entry Door and Acclaim Windows series. And the deal is this, you get four at the regular price, the fifth one absolutely free. Call 207-275-6622 or visit renewalbyanderson.com. The better way to a better window. Here in the second hour, we'll get a look at sports headlines, check out the weather forecast heading into the weekend, a look at what's going on, brought to you by FA Peabody Insurance, the good, the bad, and the ugly, the calendar, the birthday list, and Carrie will check out the best of the social media world on the grapevine. Up first this hour, though, we're happy to welcome back to the show an actor, writer, well, a member of the Downtown Hall of Fame. You know him from films like Risky Business, Better Off Dead, television shows like Moonlighting, where he starred as Herbert Viola, Supernatural. But of course, he will always be known as Dudley Dawson, Booger, from Revenge of the Nerds, which celebrates its 40th anniversary this summer. To talk about that and more, we're happy to welcome back to the program our friend Curtis Armstrong. Well, Curtis, first of all, happy anniversary. 40 years, where did that time go?
For Revenge of the Nerds, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of shocking when you consider that we were doing a movie at the time, which we didn't have any anticipation would even... I mean, no one wanted to do that movie. It just seemed so, you know, nerdy. and we didn't think it was going to have any kind of following. I mean, we thought it was going to be lucky to open on a transatlantic flight. It was just not it was not something that was in our wheelhouse, really. Any of us, the actors, the director, it was just not. And then, it opened and it was, successful for a movie like that. Not earth-shaking, but successful. But it came at a time when everything was sort of happening at once in its favor. I mean, that movie came out, and at the same time, we had the rise of cable television, and conventions were becoming more and more popular, which sort of drew the fan base. So all of those things combined, just it never went away, and it got more and more popular. And it's hard to believe that it's being celebrated at different events around the country now. This year, for the rest of this year.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. And you not only didn't want to do the film, you didn't even audition for the part of Dudley Dawson because in its original incarnation, it was such a minor role.
Yeah, it had no, there were a few lines, I think. My recollection is that the original script, you sort of had Booger, who was... it was the same basic character, but he was sort of what Ogre was to the Alpha Betas. They each group had somebody really disgusting, and but there was very little in it. So when I at that point I'd already done Risky Business, but I don't think it had been released yet. And I thought at the time that Risky Business was a fluke. I mean, I thought it was something that was going to be, my one movie. I was a stage actor. That was what I had always wanted to be. And the fact that I'd done this movie was, a nice thing, but never thought I would continue making movies or television, anything like that. So I was just, thinking this is just so ridiculous compared to Risky Business. The script was not Risky Business. That's about all you can say about it. And on the other hand, I was reading for the part, the other lead, that was Robert Carradine and Anthony Edwards. Ultimately, I was reading for Anthony's part, and at least it was a lead, so I thought it was okay. But then they gave the part to Anthony, who of course is, you can't imagine anyone else in it, l let alone me. And so then it became, well, we're going to offer you something else. And I was going, but what? I mean, it's not Lamar. It can't be Wormser or Takashi. So I narrowed it down based on that original script to either
Poindexter.
Poindexter or Booger. And I said it, I told my agent if they offered me Booger to, I was going to turn it down. And then the agent called back and said, well, they offered you Booger. And I said, okay. And now, 40 years later, that's the name that gets yelled at me in the street. So you never know.
We're talking with Curtis Armstrong here on Downtown. The film, as you mentioned, came at an interesting time for the studio as well, because they were in some financial trouble and were very much in need of a hit.
Yeah, I don't know that it was that kind of a hit. I mean, there are people who you could talk to who could be, have more information about that. My recollection was it was, I mean, certainly critically, it was a bomb. But on the first release of the film, it did well. It probably did better than they were expecting it to do, so it's a win automatically. But it wasn't the kind of hit that would get the studio out of financial trouble. It wasn't a Star Wars or something like that.
Jeff Canoe was brought in to direct, and one of the things that made this such a good experience for you and the rest of the cast was his approach, which was to get actors to collaborate.
Oh, it was wonderful. And, somebody like, for example, Tim Busfield was a great improviser and came up with suggestions constantly. And Bobby and Tony would be off to one's our scenes together. But none of that would have been possible if it hadn't been for Jeff Canoe and his approach. I don't know whether it was because everyone began to sort of feel as if, well, there's not a lot riding on this, so we can, take a chance. Certainly, we were shooting in Tucson, Arizona, so we were a long way from 20th Century Fox. So you didn't have people sort of peering over your shoulder at what you were doing there. And I think there were some rough patches at the beginning, but it eventually smoothed out, and it became obvious Jeff was the person to do this film.
And you write.
And by the way, also the screenwriters, Steve and Jeff, who didn't just drop the script and leave. I mean, they were involved in rewriting deep into it and were had an excellent ear to what needed to be said and done. So they were important too, as were the producers, Steve Tisch and all of the, everybody involved, Peter McGregor Scott, everybody involved was the right person at the right time.
Was it a sign of your maybe ambivalence about the role that you really wanted to cut Booger's first line?
Oh, I wanted to cut all of Booger's lines. I mean, ironically, considering the fact that, you know, I dismissed the idea of doing it to begin with, not just because it was a disgusting character, but, you know, initially because there were no lines at all. And then when I realized I was going to be on screen doing these vile, unsanitary things, I kept wanting to cut down my screen time as much as possible so maybe no one would notice I was there. I wasn't really thinking very clearly, I guess. And ultimately, I think once we got into it and everybody was working together, it changed everyone's perspective. Not with the idea of where the movie was going to go. I don't think any of us thought much more about that, but we were happy with what we were doing, what we were trying to do. So it changed definitely during the course of that shoot.
Like any good classically trained actor, you created a backstory for Dudley Dawson and then realized that maybe it wasn't just his backstory.
Oh, it was definitely my backstory. You know, it's a different thing. You know, it was a system that we'd been trained in at the Academy. The idea being, you know, whatever the size of the role makes no difference. What you wind up doing is you make a backstory and you live that backstory. And the audience will never know what your backstory is, but the confidence that you bring to your performance is definitely improved by the fact that you know who you are. It doesn't matter if they say who you are.
Right.
It's what you know that counts. So I sat down in my notebook that I had at the time and wrote out Booger's story. And it wasn't for years that I discovered, I found it again and was looking at it and went, this is me.
like you, like others on the film, Robert Carradine wasn't absolutely sold on the idea of this film. And he also had the additional weight of Hollywood history and that name.
Yeah, that was a dynastic name, the Carradines. And you know, Robert was aware of that. And on the one hand, although he'd been working since he was, you know, a teenager I mean, his first movie was with John Wayne in The Cowboys. So, you know, he had a history as a film actor. But I think this was, I seem to remember that this was his first leading role, and it was in Revenge of the Nerds. So he had sort of mixed feelings about that. And then there's the story, which we were together at a con a few weeks ago, and he told the story again about when the film premiered and in Westwood, and he took John Carradine, his father, to see it. And the great John Carradine is sitting there watching this Revenge of the Nerds. And afterwards, Bobby said, "So what do you think, Dad?" And Carradine said, "Well, son, it isn't Shakespeare."
That it is not. I wrote it down. I want to make sure I get the quote right. In your book, you described the set as the most gleefully debauched set you've ever been on.
Yeah, well, that was another thing about the timing of this, because we were shooting it in early 1983 or 4. I think it was released in 80, no, we filmed it in 84. It was released in 84, I think. But whatever, it was a time, as they say. So there was a lot of partying and general misbehavior, and you know, it's you're young and you're spending 11 weeks out of town. Yeah. That's about all you can say.
And John Goodman's room was the epicenter of that activity.
Well, for a while, you know, he was so genuine and generous. You know, it was exciting for us to be around him, period. And he was terrific. I mean, his performance was terrific. And you know, we would gather in different people's rooms. His was certainly during that period when he was there, we would all go to John's room. And it would be, you know, late nights of loud music and partying it was just and he was terrific. He put up with us, you know, we were all in awe of him. And so anyway.
I love the story of the night Ted McGinley came in from the cold.
Oh yeah, Ted. Well, we see that was the difference was for us, it was a we sort of wound up dividing. We were talking about this at the con, actually, that we would divide up, not deliberately, but in to a great extent, the alpha betas partied together and the nerds partied together, and that was just sort of the way it fell out. And I don't know what the alpha betas were doing, the actors I'm talking about
Right.
now, what they were doing at their parties, but when Ted showed up at our parties, it was an eye-opener.
We're talking with Curtis Armstrong here on Downtown. So a movie that you really didn't want to do at first, you didn't think would be a worthy successor to Risky Business. What did Revenge of the Nerds do for your career?
Well, I mean, you know, by the time it came out, I was already doing another film. I was doing Clan of the Cave Bear up in Canada. And in fact, a bunch of us went down. We were at this ski resort in Penticton, I think, in British Columbia, where we were shooting the interiors of our place, of our film. And we went down to Vancouver to see Revenge of the Nerds. The whole cast went. And you know, I think it didn't exactly typecast me. I continued to do the sort of role that I had been doing in one way or another since Risky Business, which was, you know, the secondary, you know, comic support. You know, it was with different actors and different types of films. It definitely made me more known, which helps. But I never did a role like Booger again. I mean, you know, they were certainly doing role characters like that in films, but I can't say that I was really doing them. I mean, the for the remainder of that, I mean, there were certainly elements of Booger in Better Off Dead, which was a couple of years later, but Better Off Dead was partially inspired by Revenge of the Nerds and Risky Business by Savage Steve Holland. So there was a little bit of Booger in that, but the rest, you know, the other things that I did during that decade and on were not like that. So I never felt it did anything but good for me. The only thing that I felt at the time a little conflicted about was, you know, it was so against everything that I was, and it took a while for me to realize that was a good thing. Because ultimately, I wound up looking back on it and thinking that was a pretty good acting job. You know, it wasn't Shakespeare, as John would say, but it was a good acting job.
Why do you think this movie has had the kind of legs it's had that not just still popular, but new generations have embraced it? Even though not everything in there has aged well, it was a different time.
No, it was definitely a different time. And it's, you know, it's the reason that you know, Revenge of the Nerds will never wind up on any, you know, list of 1980s movies that are significant. because it is a thing that it was coming out of that period, that 60s, 70s period of being able to use what is essentially a statutory rape done in a comic way. That kind of thing would not be acceptable anymore. There's a lot of the humor in it, which sort of is of another period. But a lot of people tend to overlook that and say, well, what matters is that last scene where all of the nerds are together and staking their nerd name to the whole world and saying, yes, I'm a nerd, I'm proud of it. I mean, that last scene, to some extent, is what winds up being the thing that people remember with fondness. And then when you go back, you go, yee. You look at some of the other stuff. But I think that that's the reason why it's still, people tend to give it a break, is that its heart was in the right place.
Well, and I think it's that feeling, that sentiment that kept the movie out there in the public eye for people for all those decades, and then led to a really wonderful reality series and a chance for you to see how many people out there embraced what you had all created.
Well, yeah, to some degree, but in King of the Nerds, one of the things that we discovered was a lot of the contestants on King of the Nerds weren't necessarily, I mean, they were aware of Revenge of the Nerds, and some of them, I guess, liked it, but it wasn't all Revenge of the Nerds fans, really. It was nerds. It was people who came out of that period, or whose parents came out of that period, more likely. But, you know, the nerd culture had moved on and evolved so much since 1984 that, you know, these people were all part of a culture we hadn't even imagined when we did Revenge of the Nerds. So there were some of them who didn't know who Bobby and I were at all. So the Revenge of the Nerds wasn't a big, Revenge of the Nerds was really a selling tool for the network more than it was for the contestants. The contestants were people who, whatever area of nerd they embraced, whether it was cosplay or science or, you know, whatever it was, they had their own world of nerddom that Bobby and I are, you know, had no connection with at that time. King of the Nerds for me was an education. Because once we got these 11 or 12 people on our show, it was constant discovery of this is what nerds do now. And fortunately, I happen to love that stuff. So for me, it was a revelation.
Do you have a lot of events coming up this summer to commemorate the anniversary?
Yeah, it's a strange time. So it's the 40th anniversary, and there are cons in different cities. The Day of the Dead con is sponsoring four of them, I think, in different locations. We've already done the one in Long Island, and we've got one coming up in Albuquerque and a bunch of places around the country between now and August. No, later, now in September, I think.
Well, I have to tell you, first of all, I'm so excited that Moonlighting is available and streaming now. Oh, man, it's been so great to go back and rewatch those episodes. And we were talking earlier about your classic training. And I think my all-time favorite episode is Atomic Shakespeare. And I mean, you just knocked it out of the park in that.
Well, I mean, that was funny because we were we were doing, our schedule on moonlighting was ridiculous. It was months and months and months. And I had been offered a summer at New Jersey Shakespeare Festival, where I had already acted before, and there was some Shakespeare that I'd been offered to do. I forget what now. But I went to the producers about it, and I said, I've got this, Shakespeare thing coming up, and is there a chance I can, I can. And they went, well, no, it's going to conflict, but don't worry, we may have something for you that you'll appreciate. And it turned out to be Atomic Shakespeare. So I did my Shakespeare after all.
I have to ask you because I know what a big Beatles fan you are. What did you think of the so-called new Beatles single that came out a few months ago?
Oh, I thought it was about what I expected. We'd been sort of prepared for that back when they released the previous two new Beatles things. I was less interested in it than I was with Peter Jackson's Get Back, which I've now watched twice. So that'll give you an idea of what I think of that.
Well, and I guess what I want to believe and what I came out of the Peter Jackson film believing, having also watched it twice, was that that was a much more accurate depiction of where the guys were than what we saw in Let It Be all those years ago.
Right, yeah. I mean, it was sad to see the Let It Be in a way. I mean, at the time, I remember seeing it in the theater and going, oh, what a terrible way for this to end. And you definitely do feel it was probably more true to life and definitely more fun to watch. In retrospect, I think the original film, Let It Be, will still stand on its own as a take of that period. But Peter Jackson's world is more fun to be in, definitely.
And have you heard about the new project that I'm trying to think who is involved with it, but it's going to be four films
Oh,
focusing on each of the Beatles.
oh. Yeah, that's going to be fun. I'm looking for it. I am actually. My daughter lives in England, and last November for my birthday, Elaine, my wife, and I went over to celebrate my birthday
Oh, I
in
love the
England.
pictures that you shared on social media. That was
Yeah,
wonderful.
but that was all a surprise. I thought I was going to be in London for 2 weeks. And I thought it's a long time, but I love London, so that'll be fine. And then, they wind up taking me to Liverpool, lifelong dream. And I just spent days going from place to place and tour to tour and location to location, still recovering from it.
Well, Curtis, it's always great to talk with you. Again, happy anniversary, the 40th of Revenge of the Nerds. Have fun visiting with the many, many fans throughout the summer and hope your summer goes exceedingly well. And we'll
Thank
catch
you.
up with you again down the road.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
What a great guy, Curtis Armstrong, celebrating the 40th anniversary of Revenge of the Nerds and more here on Downtown.